Bill, like to turn it over to Representative Moline for her presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Is this thing on? To House File 2421. So this bill came to me from a couple constituents, and it's regarding firearm forfeiture in deer baiting cases. So the current law is that if you violate deer baiting statutes, which is having bait placed near the place that you hunt within 10 days prior to season starting, the DNR issues you a citation and then can subsequently forfeit your firearm and also take away your hunting privileges for the following year. What my bill does is it still allows forfeiture of a firearm, but it requires that the person actually kill a deer with the aid of bait, or that they have a previous deer baiting violation within the previous 3 years. And the reason it came to me is because these are first-time citations. They've never had a deer baiting citation before. They didn't actually shoot a deer, but yet their firearm was forfeited. Under Minnesota law, deer baiting is only a petty misdemeanor, which is a non-criminal offense. The maximum fine is $300 for a petty misdemeanor in Minnesota, yet the consequences they're suffering is having their firearm taken away, which can sometimes be worth a couple $1,000s, can sometimes be a family heirloom, and so I just don't feel that the sort of punishment meets the offense. So what we're doing is all the other sanctions remain in place. You still get a citation for deer baiting. You still lose your privilege to hunt for at least the next deer season. And you still have to pay the fine. But unless you've had a prior deer baiting citation, or unless you actually shoot a deer, the DNR can't forfeit your firearm until you meet one of those two conditions. And I don't know exactly how many firearms are forfeited as a result of deer baiting that doesn't result in actually shooting a deer, but I did pull up some stats from 2012 in which the DNR confiscated 135 firearms just for deer baiting. And several of them must have been my constituents because I heard from them. So that's my purpose of bringing the bill forward.
Okay, very good. Representative Hansen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moline, is this that case where we had that, I remember a photo with a field and a large naturally occurring pile of pumpkins that were there that went to the Supreme Court on baiting? Is this that case, or was that another case of a large amount of pop pumpkins that were piled in front of deer stands naturally occurring?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, there is actually an exception in statute that I think was added because of that case, and that's that if you're in an agricultural area where you're growing corn or pumpkins, which was the case in that, that you're not subject to the deer baiting statute. So this, unless you're actually baiting, but if you're in a crop field and there happens to be food there for the deer, I don't believe you're subject to the deer baiting statute. So no, this is not a result of that.
All right, follow-up question, Representative Hansen.
So it's not, you know, filling up the truck with a bunch of pumpkins and dumping them in front of your stand, not baiting. I mean, I have to tell you, Representative Moline, I'm really kind of cautious about going backwards on this because I can see on inadvertent things, let's say speeding, you know, where you might have a heavy foot. But if you're hunting over bait, you know you're hunting over bait. I mean, you're even if you don't get the deer, you put the bait out. And so that it's not passive. It's an active act. And so I'm not sure I want to do this.
Representative Maleen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, this isn't at all condoning deer baiting. Deer baiting is still going to remain illegal. You're still going to be cited by the DNR. You're still going to pay your fine. You're still going to lose your right to hunt. And you're still going to have that on your record as far as a DNR violation goes. All this says is unless you shoot a deer or unless you have a previous citation, even if you didn't shoot a deer, the DNR can't forfeit your firearm. And again, it just goes to, does the punishment meet the crime? It's a petty misdemeanor offense. Maximum fine is $300. Petty misdemeanor is non-criminal. Should a person end up having to pay $2,000 in a loss of a firearm for a non-criminal offense? Mm-hmm. So I'm just trying to line up the punishment and the offense here. I'm not in any way condoning deer baiting. They're still subject to all the other penalties. And if they deer bait twice, then they will have their firearm forfeited as they should, because you would think you would learn your lesson the first time around.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a question, Representative Maleen, and that has to do with, and I don't know the answer, maybe you do, or, you know, DNR. When someone applies for a hunting license, is there discussion in a brochure that's given to them or in the license application that they are not to do baiting?
Representative Maleen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Benson. I don't know that for sure. I would imagine that it's in the DNR regulation book that baiting is a violation of Minnesota law. I think most Minnesota hunters probably know that. I would think not very many hunters realize that they could have their firearm forfeited for baiting. And Representative Hansen used the example of a truckload of pumpkins, but we're talking about a lot smaller amount of food. And sometimes people do put it 100 yards from their stand and set up their trail cam to see what the activity is before season starts. And an area is actually considered baited unless you completely remove the product 10 days before season starts. And I think a lot of people probably don't know that. Now, do they have access to that information? Yeah. I mean, anybody has access to the information of what the regulations are.
Just a follow-up
question, Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So let's say someone put out corn or other products before hunting season, and it was out there for weeks and weeks, and so the deer have learned that this is a place they can come and graze. And then the day before hunting season begins, the prospective hunter takes those things away. Is such activity innocent activity? It seems to me, you know, that they're representing the law in some way. But
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, that would still be deer baiting. Even if they remove the food before deer season starts. And yes, deer baiting is illegal, and they're, you know, deliberately putting the feed there. I'm not disagreeing with you on any of those points, that those actions would be deliberate. Again, this just goes to whether or not the punishment meets the offense. And I can think of very other few areas of law where somebody who's subject to a petty misdemeanor pays thousands of dollars, basically, worth of penalties for a non-criminal offense. In fact, I can't really think of any except possibly drug forfeiture laws.
Mm-hmm. Representative Bennett?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quick, and I just wonder if DNR would be willing to come down and specifically go through exactly how carefully or how easy it would be or how obvious it might be for someone who applies for a hunting license to be informed that they're not to do baiting.
Welcome.
What's the literature look like, for example, on that?
Welcome to the committee. If you could please introduce yourself and then go ahead and respond to the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Rodman Smith, Assistant Director for Enforcement, Department of Natural Resources. Mr. Chair, Representative, when people buy a hunting license in the state of Minnesota, they are given the option of having a synopsis, and that's in that synopsis is the basically a synopsis of all the hunting laws, and there is a section in the synopsis that does address baiting. And that's a copy of the synopsis that every hunter gets. There's a similar one for fishing. and those are offered to people when they do purchase their license. So that, I believe, is 2012s. I didn't have a current one, so then it is addressed in there.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Smith. Representative Benson.
Thank you. And just a quick follow-up. Did you say they get the synopsis only if they ask for it, or is it given to everyone who applies for a license?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, they're supposed to be offered it when they purchase it, but the network that we have for selling licenses are gas stations, Walmarts. I mean, you could have a 17-year-old kid at a Walmart that was in electronics one day and selling fishing licenses the next, and they might not know to give it to the person. Yeah. But they are usually there, made available to people.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Benson. Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair and committee members, just for some background on this, in respect to the people that don't hunt, if you're a hunter, you'd have to be somebody that rode up here from Florida on a peach train to not know about baiting. It's been highlighted in Outdoor News, the Trib, the Pioneer Press. There's been sports articles about it, and it's in the synopsis, and the penalties used to be greater than what they are now. I think if we didn't take the firearm, we should probably raise the penalty to $1,000 then, because the problem is if the fine is so cheap now and it's not a criminal conviction, that if we water it down and take away the ability to take the firearm away, then we've probably put it to nothing. There's lots of violations where you don't have to have a actually shoot the deer or harm wildlife, where they take your equipment away. And then we've gotten harder on violations lately in fish and game. We've even attached restitution, not only the fines. We've made it quite expensive to violate the game laws. So that's the problem that I have, is that we wither it down to nothing. And the DNR, and I think a lot of wildlife groups, have found out that baiting is quite harmful to deer instead of helping. And so it's just, I really would worry about this, about not the ability to take the firearm away. And I've taken literally hundreds of firearms away when I was a conservation officer. I don't think any one of them ever approached over $350 value, probably. But so I worry about the thing. I think it would be, there's officer discretion involved. You don't always have to take the firearm. I wrote a lot of fishing licenses where I didn't take the equipment, and a lot of other violations where I didn't take the equipment. And so it's just a worrisome thing to me if we water it down too much. Thank you.
Representative Isaacson.
Thank you. Just to make sure, the gentleman from the DNR, I just have a question for you on this. just out of curiosity, about how many, do you have an idea of how many firearms you're taking away a year in this situation due to catching people?
Mr. Chair, Representative, each year, I ran some numbers before I came, and mm-hmm. we read about 150 citations for the last 3 years in a row, mm-hmm. about 50 warnings, and about 135 to 140 of those 150 citations result in a firearms confiscation.
Okay.
And if I could just make one point of clarification, that it is a misdemeanor under game and fish law to be for baiting deer. All, under 97B, it is a misdemeanor. It is not a petty misdemeanor.
Well, just, Mr. Chair, just in response to that, that is accurate. It is a misdemeanor, and I misspoke, but the Supreme Court puts these misdemeanors, primarily ones in the game and fish laws, onto what's called a payables list, so it becomes a petty misdemeanor. So if you are cited for a violation of the game and fish laws, although it's codified as a misdemeanor, if you pay your fine, it's a petty misdemeanor, and it's subject only to the penalties of a petty misdemeanor. So it is correct that in statute it's a misdemeanor, but again, the Supreme Court puts together a payables list that essentially makes misdemeanors petty misdemeanors.
I think
Representative Isaac.
Thank you, sir, Mr. Chair. And either my esteemed colleague or the gentleman from the DNR can answer this question. What was the impetus? Is there I'm wondering, is it broken the way it is right now? Are we having a problem with this? Why are we pushing this idea? Just so I understand, I don't really know. I'm not a hunter, so I can't speak with the authority that Representative Cornish does, but it seems to me, unless there's a problem, I don't know, does it need to be fixed?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Smith isn't here testifying in favor of my bill, so maybe we would probably answer that question differently. the problem I see is I heard from a few constituents who ran into this issue.
Okay.
I mean, there was 135 firearms confiscated. A majority of those, I think, were in northeastern Minnesota from what I saw. And so they were first-time violations. They didn't shoot a deer. And they felt that, you know, losing a firearm that was worth $1,500, $1,800 was a pretty stiff penalty for what they had done. And so, again, I'm not condoning deer baiting in any way.
Right.
And just for clarity, you know, although it's a misdemeanor, a petty misdemeanor, however you want to phrase it, they do still lose their hunting license for a year, which I think is reasonable. That doesn't change under this bill. They would still lose their hunting license. And again, if they've had a prior citation, they would still have their firearm forfeited.
Okay. Okay. Thank you for also making the clarification. I wasn't sure what the dividing line here was. I have another question. Thank you. This is for the well, either one, but I think it's a DNR question. Can you accidentally be baiting? I'm not a hunter, so I don't know. Is it possible to accidentally bait?
Wait a minute. How come you have all the wolf bills then if you're not a hunter?
Doesn't that answer its own question, really? Thank you. I think you answered your own question there. But
sir, if you'd answer.
You could answer. I mean, is it possible that you could be caught accidentally baiting and not be aware of it?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative, I guess the only way I could think of that would be under two scenarios. One, you're a sloppy eater and your deer stand and you have a lot of food fall off.
Which I could be guilty of that. That's fair.
And number two could be if you were involved in some type of agricultural practice that may where you remove some crops and then don't put them back like we had just changed here a few years back. You may not know that you're violating the baiting law.
Okay.
But like I said, we didn't have a strict liability where we wrote everybody a ticket. We did exercise warnings and other things in the field. Our officers do use discretion.
So if there's McDonald's wrappers and other things and the baiting occurs, you're aware that that's the case. I just want to make sure I understand the distinction, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I understand, and I certainly have constituents that come to me with ideas that I think are important, and I'm in no way, with no disrespect intended, I don't know why this is necessary to change it. I don't feel comfortable changing it. I think that if there's a law in place, and you know your laws, and you should probably follow the laws, especially if you're walking around with firearms. I think that's pretty crucial. And so I don't know that I could support this, but I'm not sure what your intention is, if it's going to be laid over or for a vote. I don't know.
Well, it'll be laid over today, but it's going to pass.
You like that?
You know,
well, now I have another mission. Nice.
I think Representative Moline, well, first off, Representative Hackford.
That answered my question, Mr. Chairman. Just when I wanted to know where I was traveling and how.
Yep. This happens a lot in northeastern Minnesota because a lot of people come up there deer hunting and they go home without a firearm. I mean, they get them taken away. Local people get them taken away. And this all came through at one time, the losing the privileges and the firearm, the confiscation, if I remember. Is that correct? It was at two different times? But, I mean, Representative Moline hit it right. I mean, there's a fine, and they lose their hunting privileges for a year. Mm-hmm. For being in the, how do you term that, being the practice taking of deer. The word taking is where the problem is.
Mm-hmm.
Taking can be, well, Representative Moline, can you explain what taking means?
Yeah, so the statute says, Mr. Chair, the statute says take, which I think of take as you actually kill the deer and take it with you, but it's hunting. So anything in the pursuit of hunting, walking to your deer stand, crawling up into your deer stand, under the statutes, that's the definition of take.
So, can I ask a question? So when you say that, and I'm always happy to be educated on these things, so when you say the taking, that means that if we catch someone who is, by all accounts, according to the judgment of the DNR officer, baiting for a deer, but hasn't caught the deer yet, you're concerned that we shouldn't be taking their firearm. However, if 15 minutes later they have caught the deer, then you have no problem with them taking away their firearms. I would respect.
Representative Isaacson, that's what the bill.
I would respectfully disagree with that. Thank you.
Other questions? Oh, Representative Guinness, I'm sorry.
My only question is, if are you going to have the Deer Hunters Association chat with us now, or is it at another time when this comes up again? I just your choice.
I think they're coming up right now, Representative Riccobino. I have Riccobino on the brain because we just found in the tax committee, we just found that Representative Riccobino passed a law that got him 3 cents for a project, not 3 cents per ton times 80 million tons. And so, I mean, this is a great day.
We're about the same size, Mr. Chairman.
I want you to know that I amended it so he got his 3 cents per ton.
3 cents. Mr. Chairman,
thank you to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the record. Corey Bennett representing the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association. I do have to say that since this was just introduced about a week ago, I would say we have not had a chance to fully vet this within the Deer Hunters Association. We had our annual meeting a couple of weeks ago in which we took up bills that had already been introduced and took official positions. I can say that we don't have official position on this. So we probably are neutral. I mean, I could guess where we would probably be on this if you would like me to, Mr. Chairman. I can't imagine there would be a hunter that would like to lose their weapon on a first violation. We certainly do not condone baiting. We strongly oppose any baiting of any kind. But certainly, as Representative Moline said, there are fines in place. You do lose your deer hunter's license. And so I can imagine where we would come down on this if we were to take an official position, which would probably be to support or to look at some other variation. I would do think that maybe one of the things we could look at is on page 1, lines 1.1, looking at the 3 years, if that's a possibility that somehow maybe we move that up a little bit for a second violation to maybe a 5 or 7 or 8 or possibly 10 years. I'm not going to try to figure out what that should be for the committee, but that might be something so that if for some reason somebody on their first offense inadvertently for some reason was written up for this offense, that if it ever happened again within that 10-year period, they would lose their firearm. I could see something like that as a possibility, Mr. Chairman.
Questions for Mr. Bennett? It doesn't appear to be. Anyone in the audience like to testify for or against the bill? All right. I had a question for Mr. Smith. Is the suspension of the hunting privileges only related to the big game? I think that's how that was passed.
Mr. Chair, you're correct.
Okay, so it doesn't have to do with small game. They wouldn't, nothing, duck hunting, pheasant hunting, just big game. Okay. Representative Moline, further comment?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It looks like Mr. Smith maybe wants to make a comment. I'll let him go first.
Mr. Chair, I guess I've answered a few questions, but I haven't had a chance to speak to the bill, if that's okay.
That would be okay.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, just for the benefit of some of the members and kind of where we got to with baiting and why the department as a whole frowns on baiting is, first off, it is feeding deer and feeding wildlife, and our department is averse to people feeding deer because of the very real threat of spreading disease when they get nose to nose. And so as a whole, the department doesn't like the fact of feeding deer. And when baiting started, the fine was about $100, and after a few years, that fine got raised to $300. A few years after that, we still couldn't stop the baiting, and we started seizing firearms. And then just last year, because there was still problems with people baiting, we started, the legislature enacted the law to allow for the revocation of hunting privileges. And what sets baiting apart a little bit from other violations of game and fish law is that it really is a premeditated act. Somebody has to go out ahead of time before they're in the field, locate a place to put the bait, and then dump the bait there. And many times they make multiple trips. Whereas a lot of the other violations that we see in game and fish law tend to be more sometimes violations of opportunity, violations of circumstance. And what we're seeing now is actually quite remarkable. There is a bright line, and one, I believe Representative Corner said that if you're hunt up here, if you live up here, you don't know that baiting's illegal, because it has been a big issue. And what we're seeing is that we're seeing people that hunt in the same party turn in other party members because they believe that strongly in it. We have family members turning in family members. And what we're starting to see now is not the same person baiting and throwing out corn, but now they're buying camouflage corn. Now they're buying camouflaged feeders. They're hiding it. And so the cases that we do make are pretty darn good cases, because these people had the intent not only to do it ahead of time, to go out there and place the bait ahead of time, but they're actively trying to conceal the activity at the same time. So I think this does throw this into a different, little bit of a different category. We're not getting the person that doesn't know that it's illegal to bait. When we do run across those, like I said, we have used discretion. We haven't gone strictly to writing everybody citations. We have written people warnings. You know, we haven't seized firearms in every single violation. So I think the department's taken a very good measured response to this issue, and I think it sends a very poor message back to the hunting community now we're going backwards a little bit on this. But I appreciate the opportunity to get my two cents in. Thank you.
As always, thank you. Representative Morgenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just with, as you feed animals, you're domesticating them. And this strikes me as domesticating a wild population, and this is the first step in doing that. Do you all discuss that from a biological point of view?
Mr. Chair, Representative Guinness, the discussions we have are that, and from what we hear from constituents out there that are calling in and making these complaints, is that some of them feel like deer hunting is going to become a competitive sport, where am I going to have better bait on my field than the guy next to me? And the fact that we're not going to have the traditional role of hunting where people go out and scout an area, they look for the natural deer movement, because feeding deer makes deer act differently. There are municipalities around the state that outlaw the feeding of deer in the city limits, because they get so many deer that will cross major highways. There's so many car collisions and whatnot that it becomes a safety factor. So when people do feed deer, they act differently. And so as far as the domestication portion of it, we haven't had those conversations, but they definitely do act differently.
Well, I would be interested. I mean, it does strike me that if they're acting differently, that is the first step in domestication, so that we aren't going to have the sport of hunting anymore, because it doesn't take much to domesticate an animal. If you're feeding them, you're the friend. It would be interesting for you guys to go back and discuss this with biologists and see how they feel about it.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions. Colonel Smith, does Representative Moline's bill affect, there's a very gray area in the baiting of small game, specifically waterfall and pick fields or not pick fields, and how they've been manipulated. Does this bill in any way affect, because I know you have taken or levied some pretty serious fines, I think, on folks where it was a real gray area. Does this have anything to do with that?
Perfect.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, no, it does not. And all those baiting laws are CFR, those are federal laws, and we just basically have in the state of Minnesota that a violation of federal law is a violation of state law.
Thank you. McNamara. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was pretty sure I knew the answer to that, but I do have feelings for those folks that get caught in that, because I think some of them are legitimate. I've got real reservations about people baiting deer, though. Baiting deer is unfortunately just growing exponentially and is really, really sad for folks that hunt hard and hunt fair and square. And when you hunt in the big woods, like a lot of us do up near Representative Moline's district, you have no idea. It's actually gotten to the point, and I know it happened to myself this year when we were tracking a deer and moved into some other folks' area, you're really afraid. of what you might see, and you just want to get out of there because you don't want to get caught. I mean, you're dealing with people with firearms and all kinds of things. So I guess I would just like to know the facts. I think we have to continue to come down strong. Have you seen a reduction in the amount of baiting now with the taking away their hunting privileges? I think hunting privileges are more important to folks even than the firearms. I personally don't have a problem with you taking their gun if they're baiting for deer. I'm sorry, you know if you're baiting for deer. You either are or you aren't. And unfortunately, you actually allow it. All they got to do is pick it up 10 days before they're going to hunt, and they can be legal. And whereas you can bait for a month ahead of time, and 10 days before the season opens, pick up your bait and get rid of it, and then you're legal. Have you seen a reduction in the amount of baiting going on with the increased penalties?
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, we're writing about the same amount of citations a year, but the people that we're catching are at a different classification. Earlier, we were getting those folks that were baiting, they're putting out the corn and whatnot, and we could see it from our aircraft. We could see, you know, we would make those cases. But now, the majority of the complaints that we're getting are tip calls through turn-in poachers where people are turning in other people, and they are disguising it a lot better. I mean, you'd have to know where to look in order to find it.
Rep. Emily.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, first of all, to address this, don't feed the deer. I think I just read in the news last week that the DNR is paying the Deer Hunters Association to feed the deer right now. Now, I understand that that's different because the deer are starving, and it's controlled feed as opposed to baiting, which are two very different things. But, I mean, I think if we're talking about domestication and some other things, right now we're actually, the state is feeding the deer. Because they're starving for a number of reasons, but I actually just saw two deer in downtown Hibbing last week, which is the first time in my life I've ever seen that. So, I mean, I think that we just have to be careful to think that it's only hunters out there that are somehow feeding the deer when there's actually controlled feeds going on around the state right now. And then secondly, again, nobody here is condoning deer baiting. I just want to make that very clear that, you know, I would agree that it's illegal, and I would agree that most, if not all, hunters realize that deer baiting is illegal. All I'm saying is that on the first citation, if there haven't been any priors, and I would be happy to work with the number of years of priors to, you know, lengthen it a little bit, or even for people who have had citations before that didn't actually, or warnings that didn't result in a citation, that they could be nicked on the second time around. But just to make sure that the punishment matches the offense. I mean, when you're looking at, $1,500, $2,000 gun being forfeited on your first time offense, I think that's a pretty hefty penalty, and again, I'm not, you know, sure in our criminal laws where I can really think of anything comparable to that. And there is DNR officer discretion. They could issue a warning. I'm just looking at the numbers from 2012, and there was 166 citations, 49 warnings, and 135 firearms forfeited. So under those 166 citations, there were 135 firearms forfeited. So they are forfeiting in almost every case. So there's, you know, it seems like although there's officer discretion, very few of them are actually using that to not confiscate the firearms. So again, we're not here to condone deer baiting. We're not here to say that they shouldn't lose their license or shouldn't pay the fine or shouldn't have a citation. I believe all those things should happen. It's just that on the first time offense, this changes it to not forfeit the firearm the first time around. So hopefully I can convince the rest of you the next time this comes up that it's a fair approach to still hold hunters accountable and make sure that they're following our game and fish laws, but to allow them to keep their firearm on a first-time violation.
Representative Fabian, I saw the pencil starting to wiggle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moline, just to be clear, on line 1.7, it talks about equipment seizure, and we've talked exclusively about guns today. Does that also include bows and arrows and muzzle loaders?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Moline.
My intent was to include just firearms, so I guess I don't have the full statute book in front of me, so I don't know what's in that particular section.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, being a deer hunter myself and having equipment, my sense is that equipment seizure includes bows and arrows, and maybe Colonel Smith can answer that question more clearly.
Mr. Chair?
Yep, Lieutenant, or Colonel Smith.
Representative Fabian, it would include archery equipment and muzzle loaders, and we only confiscate firearms, muzzle loaders, or archery equipment, nothing else when it comes to that.
Representative Fabian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess maybe staff can answer under Section 97A.21. What else would fall under the heading of equipment other than firearms and bows and arrows and muzzle loaders? Would it include my deer stand? Would it include my jacket, my underwear?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, it doesn't get quite that detailed, but there is a laundry list of items specifically mentioned in statute 97A.221. It's firearms, bows, archery, fishing poles. So there is a laundry list, but it does not get down to clothes and undergarments.
Now that might be an amendment in Fabian's case, but Representative Fabian.
Well then, to that point, then we talk about officers' discretion. Does the DNR have a policy about? If it's available to an officer to confiscate certain things, there's a number of cases that you've cited where they didn't confiscate something. I'm curious to know, Representative Wagenius talked in committee yesterday about fairness. Where is the fairness in the application of the rules with regards to equipment seizure?
Mr. Chair, just so I understand the question, are you saying that why were there certain cases when we didn't seize a firearm, or are you asking why are we not seizing all the equipment we possibly could? And I'd have to look at the statute to see that laundry list of things.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for clarification, that's exactly what I'm asking. I mean, why do you do it in some cases and not in others? And why do you stop at a rifle? Do you take the case? Is the vehicle a part of equipment if I'm using that to get to my deer stand and it's parked on the road?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, the reason we don't take firearms in some cases is because it does state in Section 97A.221 that it has to be used with the owner's knowledge. So there are some times where a person the firearm must be used with the owner's knowledge that it's being used in an illegal take. And so there are some times where somebody has borrowed a firearm from somebody else and from a neighbor, and the neighbor didn't know that the neighbor was baiting, so we don't seize the firearm in that case. And the equipment has to be used in the take, and we don't consider the vehicle that you drove to the spot to hunt as part of the take. We keep that separate, so... we've just been concentrating on the firearms. And again, I'd have to look at the laundry list, and I can get back with you offline and give you a better answer.
Well, Representative Fabian, I think that's the purpose of the bill. I mean, I don't deer hunt, duck hunt. I know those laws. But the purpose is for consistency. And, in my view, that if you lose your the hunting privileges to me are worth more. That's the reason I strongly support it. I think Representative McNamara was here when we passed that, I think, if I recall right. And I strongly support losing the privileges for hunting. But for a first-time offender on this, I think that we can get way too... I mean, the value of the restitution, so to speak, can be wide from an old 308 to a very expensive Weatherby rifle, and I mean, I don't see the fairness there. Now, after the first time, after a first offense or something like that, that's a whole different story. And also, I'm reading in the 2012 and I don't have 2013, but it says new laws. This is the, you know, our pamphlet. And it doesn't say anything that I can find real quickly about confiscation of the gun. It talks about hunting, being convicted, 3-year revocation, and then also restitution for conviction on a trophy over 170 inches. But it doesn't say anything about the gun, in this at least. Now, I'm not saying I have the latest. And just Representative Cornish to that point.
Well, it was to the point you were talking about. It's just the problem is that baiting deer is like a DWI. You catch them the first time. They've done it 90 times before and got by with it. Baiting deer is similar. They're getting pros at it now. And it's very hard to detect them, and they love what they're doing, and they do it effectively. And so when you finally do catch them, they've been getting by with it for a long time. Mm-hmm. I just hope if the bill does pass, you narrow this just to this deer feeding issue, because there's, you know, shooting deer at night, you take their car sometimes. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is very serious or something. And you can take, I think the laundry list includes nets for illegal netting. Yeah. You could probably even take a boat if it's used in illegal gill netting for game fish, things like this. So I just hope we don't get into any other area here but baiting. So.
Okay, Representative Borg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm assuming, but I haven't heard it, that when you take the equipment, you're also taking, you talked about the camouflage and that they're getting really good at hiding this, that there must be something that you're taking that the officer could also take to say, you can't use this anymore to hide your bait.
Colonel Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we looked at doing that, but we don't have the authority under 97A221 to take those implements because it is a laundry list of items.
Mm. Yeah. Good.
I am not a hunter, but I grew up with hunters. And I grew up hunting with my family, though I wasn't using the firearms. And my dad is still alive, still has all of his hunting equipment and fishing equipment. And when it comes to these kinds of things that I don't have any personal experience with in this stage in my life, I rely on his sense of morality, and I know that he would be totally against the baiting, and knowing that if you're out with a firearm, you know what the rules are. And breaking the rules by baiting would just be abhorrent to him. And this is not a bill that I could support.
Well, okay. I want to make sure that I think that we're not supporting baiting. That's not what we're not saying that we weren't baiting.
I understand.
Okay. So, we happen to have the washing machine full of laundry list here, right here at the front desk. So, based on that, we'll have Ms. Taylor read that laundry list and throw maybe Colonel Smith can throw a little Tide on it, and we'll make it better.
Mr. Chair, members, the list reads firearms, bows and arrows, nets, boats, lines, poles, fishing rods and tackle, lights, lanterns, snares, traps, spears, dark houses, fish houses, and wild rice harvesting equipment that are used with the owner's knowledge to unlawfully take or transport wild animals, wild rice, or other aquatic vegetation.
Anyone have any questions on the laundry list? Any further questions on the bill? Being none, anyone like to testify for or against the bill? None, the chair will lay the bill over. Thank you, Representative Moline.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So the next bill before us, members, is House File 2542, Representative Portman. And Representative Portman, do you want to adopt the author's amendments to get the bill in the shape that you'd like the bill?
I would appreciate that, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. So the chair will move the bill, House File 2542, and that'll go eventually to the Consumer Protection Finance and Policy Committee. Chair also moved the 2542A1. In favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And then we have the 0819. A14 amendment. Is that correct?
Yep.
And so the chair will move that. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Now we have House File 2542 before us as amended. Representative Portman, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this is a policy bill brought to me by the Pollution Control Agency because I've carried a number of bills in the past banning different mercury products. Over time, we've gradually stepped forward in taking certain mercury products off the market when the market's been ready and there are alternatives available because of the harm that mercury poses. This particular bill deals with reducing the presence of both mercury and lead in the environment. And to explain the bill, with me here today is John Gilkison from the Pollution Control Agency.
Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Portman, members. My name is John Gilkison. I'm with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. The overall goal of this bill is to continue reductions in the use and release of lead and mercury in the state in favor of substances and products that are not toxic and provide comparable or superior performance. Lead and mercury are the two most toxic elements that are still commonly used in products in commerce, and they are on every list of priority chemicals at the state, national, and international level. In addition, the U.S. just signed the Mercury Convention that was enacted globally in October 2013, and this commits the U.S. at least to further reductions in mercury, and I hope that we can follow suit with that. There's no human or wildlife benefit from consuming these elements, and there's no safe level of exposure, particularly for prenatal, infant, and childhood exposure. The exposure release takes place in manufacturing and use, and also when products are discarded or mismanaged. Most of the proposals in this bill take a pollution prevention approach, that is, by phasing out the use of the lead and mercury in favor of less toxic or non-toxic alternatives. We also have management approaches in the legislation since we have lead and mercury products that are currently in use and they need to be properly managed when they're removed from service. So we have six sections in this bill. The first two sections broaden the mercury product management requirements and disposal prohibitions that are now in state law, and we broaden that from categories of products or specific types of products to all mercury-containing products. As an agency, we're frequently running across mercury products that don't fit into the categories that are currently in law, so the requirements for labeling or proper management don't neatly apply, and we sometimes have difficulty with both outreach and enforcement around these products. We propose to change the language so that labeling disposal requirements in the law apply to everything that contains intentionally added mercury in that product. Section 3 addresses mercury thermostats. It strengthens the statute that's been in effect in Minnesota since 1992. It does not change who is responsible for thermostat management, as all parties agreed to many years ago. The proposed changes explicitly assign thermostat manufacturers the financial responsibility to properly manage mercury thermostats that are removed from service. It requires manufacturers to provide incentives to boost recovery, and it requires them to report annually to the state, at least annually to the state, on the program and its performance. This information was provided voluntarily in the past, and it is no longer being provided to the agency. It also provides antitrust protection so that the manufacturers can collectively manage thermostats through a stewardship organization in the manner that works best for them. Now, there's a very large amount of mercury in thermostats that are currently coming out of service, so it's critical that they be managed properly and with accountability by the manufacturers. Section 4 eliminates obsolete allowances for the purchase and use of mercury thermometers that were included in Minnesota's landmark mercury thermometer law in 2001. Mercury thermometers are no longer required at any state or federal law or rule. They are no longer certified as primary standards by the National Institute of Standards and Technology, and there are non-mercury products available for nearly every application. The proposal allows the agency to accept an exemption that's approved by another state that's part of an interstate organization overseeing mercury product phase-outs, and we have similar language for switches and relays now that was enacted in 2007. Section 5 establishes a sales prohibition on mercury balancing, dampening, and shock-absorbing types of functions. These are generally legacy or obsolete products with large amounts of mercury that are prone to accidental release. However, some products are still being made, and there are mercury-free alternatives for every application that we're aware of. Finally, Section 6 establishes a sales and installation prohibition for wheel weights and balancing products that contain lead or mercury. This is an issue that U.S. EPA, federal, state, and local agencies and fleets have been looking at for over 10 years, particularly for lead. Minnesota has been a leader in this area, and the legislation would be a fitting conclusion to the leadership we've already taken. Our state fleet was the first state fleet to make a lead-free commitment. It pilot-tested the product that is now the 3M wheel weight system, which is a cut-to-weight adhesive polymer product. Our wheel and tire contract requires lead-free balancing, and the public school bus purchase contract requires delivery of new school buses with lead-free balancing. Six states have enacted similar legislation, including California, Illinois, Maine, New York, Vermont, and Washington. In those states, the state auto dealer associations have supported those bills, as have the wheel weight manufacturers and the new car manufacturers. And we are working with state auto dealers association here, and we've provided information to them on the alternatives for them to work with their members to take a position on this bill. We have aftermarket tire retailers who use lead-free waste, including Tires Plus, Costco, and Walmart. Currently, around 18,000 tons of lead are used per year in the U.S. for aftermarket wheel balancing, and there's an estimated 50,000 to 70,000 tons of lead on vehicle wheel weights in the U.S. There's an estimated 5 to 10% loss rate to the environment each year. In addition, when weights are removed, they're not always managed properly, and lead can be diverted to other uses where there's potential for exposure and injury. Lead has been phased out of almost all other household and consumer products. And as you saw in the A1 amendment, the proposal is intended to apply to any motor transport wheel that uses balancing. That would include construction, heavy equipment, off-road, farm, semi-trailers and cabs, and so forth. However, many of these vehicles are low-speed or off-road vehicles, and they do not currently use any wheel balancing product. So there have been some concerns about farm vehicles. Many of those don't use wheel balancing now, but there are products available for them as well. And I'd be happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Any questions for the testifier? Representative Buchan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have several questions on this bill regarding its effect on business. I think it's a well-intentioned bill, and we certainly want to get rid of mercury and lead in the environment. But on page 2, subdivision 5, with regard to thermostats, line 2.15 through 2.18, you know, we have a very large company in this state. Their headquarters are no longer here, but they made a lot of thermostats in the old days, Honeywell. And how would this language affect them? A manufacturer of thermostats that contain mercury that may replace thermostats that contain mercury is responsible for the cost of collecting and managing these thermostats. Now, there's got to be at least a million homes in Minnesota that still have your little round, bronze-colored Honeywell thermostats sitting on the wall. How is this going to affect Honeywell or a similar company?
Go ahead, sir.
Chair of Representatives Committee, Representative Ulam. Honeywell made a commitment in 1992 to operate a end-of-life thermostat collection and recycling program. And that program has been in place in Minnesota for 20-plus years. We've had reporting on the progress of that program for quite a few years, but they no longer report to us on what they're doing. We do not know what they're collecting. The recovery rate in Minnesota has never exceeded 15%. And the manufacturers have also committed to running a national program, but they do not provide any incentives and very little publicity for this program. And what this proposal does is establish in statute that they should follow up on the commitment that they made to us in 1992 to operate that program. And this is a very serious problem in terms of mercury. The amount of mercury in thermostats, there's an average of 4 grams per thermostat, and Honeywell and its contractor TRC, the Thermostat Recycling Corporation, can collect a thermostat for less than 50 cents through their program that they operate. And that is that's probably the most cost-effective mercury waste mercury collection program that anyone has So it's a minimal cost relative to the profits that they made at the time and relative to the agreement they made with you, the legislators, in 1992.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, all right, Honeywell has agreed to certain provisions in this bill, but this bill, Subdivision 5, is not going to require our companies to go out and collect these right off the walls and replace them for individual homes or anything like that.
Chair and Representative Ulam, that's correct. No one is required to replace what is currently in service.
Okay. Chair. Okay, I have another question with regard to the balancing and dampening products on page 4, 4.1 through 4.4. Do we have any idea how many businesses, particularly tire balancing businesses, which are located throughout the state, many small ma-and-pa tire shops and everything else. Do we have any idea how many businesses will be affected by this provision?
All right. Chair, Representative Ublem, are you asking about Subdivision 8K proposal on line 4.1? The proposal in 4.1 does not affect the wheel balancing section. That is covered in the wheel weight and balancing proposal. There are other products that are used for drive shaft and axle balancing. They're used for conveyor systems for bulk materials where there's a weight counterweight system containing a very large amount of mercury. And there are not a lot of these products being sold and installed today, but we know that there are a few out there, and we are having issues with proper management and end of life because people don't know what they have in their facility, and they're trying to replace it with mercury, and they're not managing the old mercury right. And so what we are trying to do with this is give us both outreach and enforcement tools to ensure that those products are managed properly when they come out of service and they're replaced with a new non-mercury product that's going to provide them with better, safer service.
Sure. So this is only when the product comes out of service. So they, it says they will not be able to sell, offer for sale. If they're existing right now,
they
will they be?
Nobody's required to remove anything from service under this proposal. They would be required to manage it properly and replace it with a non-mercury item. So they were essentially foreclosing their option to replace it with a new product or to install a new product.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Further questions? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. in a follow-up to Representative Uglum's questions, you said when we're talking about Subdivision 8K, you said we have issues. What are the issues?
One of the issues is the drive shaft balancer that uses about 30 pounds of mercury. And this is a product that's manufactured in California and sold nationally. And this is used on, it is used on truck wheels as well, so it would fall under the Section 6 of the bill. But for the Subdivision 8K proposal, we have, we know these products are being sold to use as a drive shaft balancer for aircraft and over-the-road trucks. It's a large unlabeled product that operates at high speed that contains 30 pounds of mercury. And this company will not comply with any of the labeling and sales restriction requirements that are in place in Minnesota and other states. So we have no idea where these products are being used. We have no enforcement mechanism currently in law against this kind of product because we don't cover this in our categories of mercury products. These are totally unnecessary products in the operation of these vehicles. And so that is one specific example of a product that we're trying to remove from the market and from use in Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, then, are we going to become an outlier here in Minnesota with this law?
Chair, Representative, are you asking if we are the first state that will enact this provision? No, this is prohibited in several other states as well, Connecticut, Rhode Island, Louisiana.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Any of our neighboring states, any of our border states?
Chair and Representative, I don't believe any border states have a similar provision at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it also says here, it's not just the manufacturer, it says a person may not sell. How do you define person? The guy that works in the back room, the shop, that's putting this in?
A person is a person or a corporation, I believe, Chair and Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can we get clarification from staff on the definition of person?
Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, I'm not sure with respect to this particular section of law. Let me check that out.
Thank you.
Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I guess I am concerned that we are going to become an outlier. It'd be interesting to hear from the people who are affected by this what their reason is for selling, offering for sale, distributing, or installing here in the state of Minnesota.
Chair, Representative, if you could introduce me to any people who are using this, I would be very grateful because I've been trying to find those people and talk to them about this product.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, then, if we can't find those people and we don't know that they're, what's the purpose of the bill? How are you going to enforce the laws? How is MPCA going to enforce this?
Chair, Representative, first we're going to go to the manufacturer of the product and advise them that it is illegal to sell this product into the state of Minnesota for any use whatsoever. And this gives us additional leverage against the manufacturer.
Representative Fabian, for
the
question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, back to the thermostat questions. There again, how many businesses? We mentioned the Big H. How many other businesses that are doing businesses here are going to be affected by this?
Chair and Representative, Honeywell is the only manufacturer that has or had any corporate presence in Minnesota that is a thermostat manufacturer. However, there are 35 to 40 corporations are part of the Thermostat Recycling Corporation, which includes, as far as we know, every company that made or marketed a mercury thermostat in the past. And the membership of TRC also includes other companies that did not manufacture mercury thermostats because they are selling thermostats that replace mercury thermostats. So they play a role in the recovery as well.
Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Gillickson, I'm also wondering about those other manufacturers. How are you going to enforce this? What's the enforcement mechanism?
Chair, Representative, we have that list of manufacturers. We will be communicating with them and advising them that they must participate in the Minnesota program and provide the evidence of that to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then, just say hypothetically that somebody chooses not to do that, and they are the manufacturer that supplies thermostats for the plumbing shop in Roseau or Hallock, and all of a sudden they can't get those. Have you put thought into how you're going to help those small-town businessmen get through this?
Chair and Representative, I think TRC has a much greater interest in requiring those companies to be members and participate because of the market mechanisms. And the people who are involved in that are going to be part of TRC. And they are going to, because TRC will compel them to be involved.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then earlier in your testimony, you said that we have a very large amount of mercury thermostats coming out of service. Can you give me the data on the numbers there, please?
I do not have that with me today, but I can provide that to you.
Further questions, Representative?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Thank you. To the wheel weight and balancing so forth, I do have some concerns about the scrap metal people in my area. We've had a number of issues over the last few years that they've been very active in with me personally. How is this going to change their business model, Representative? Can you, Ortman, can you answer that question, please?
Representative Portman, that's a very good question for you.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, I know as a former employee of a metal recycling facility that those of us in the automotive industry use our state association to educate ourselves about which components of the vehicle we have to handle separately. For example, mercury switches. The businesses who shred the cars that we sell them after we've crushed the vehicle don't want any of those hazardous materials in there either because it affects their emissions at the metal shredding plant. So the association does a pretty good job. As things like this come along, the association will have a little training session. You know, my husband was former president of the association, used to do these kind of training sessions to say, hey, there's a new law in case you didn't know. You got to get the stuff out of the wheels before you crush the car, before you sell the part.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hortman, and seeing as to how I live 360 miles from here, where are those training sessions held?
Representative Hortman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, last time I had dinner with members of the organization, I think their conference was at the Mall of America. I think that the folks in the association have those meetings all over the state, and the folks who do the training travel all over the state.
Representative Fabian, we have the answer to your question. Mr. Eloff has the answer. Mr. Eloff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's no definition of person that's attached to that section of law, so I'm looking in Chapter 645, which is the interpretation of statutes and rules. And there it says that person may extend and be applied to bodies politic and corporate and to partnerships and other unincorporated associations. So it will include businesses.
Thank you. So I guess what I'm somewhat concerned about is when we are saying person, you know, the person working in the shop all of a sudden is the person who's installing this, and I have some concern for that. Is my concern misplaced?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, are you asking who might be a violator?
Yes,
in that
I am.
Sense?
Representative Fabian, I think that's who's the responsible person, correct?
Mr.
That's
Chair.
What I'm asking for clarification on the bill, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, we have the same laws with regard to a person may not emit stormwater, et cetera, at John's Auto Parts. And whenever we were dealing with the PCA, they weren't asking our particular employees. They were dealing with the corporate leadership. So I just confirmed with Mr. Gilkison, and they don't go out and look for individual sales people. They're dealing with the ownership of the business to get compliance with the law.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So throughout the bill, what are the penalties?
Chair, Representative Fabian, many of the amendments proposed here are in 115A932 and 116.92, which are the mercury statutes, and they're are some specific penalty provisions in those two statutes for household or business violations. And for 116.931, the wheel weight provision, I believe that falls under the general environmental penalty provisions of Chapter 116. There is no specific difference in penalties laid out here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is it a misdemeanor? Is it a felony? Is it a fine? I'm curious.
Deb Hortman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, it's not a criminal statute, so there wouldn't be any misdemeanors or felonies. I believe that House Research is looking for the answer for us right now, but these would be in the nature of civil penalties.
We'll get back to that question, Representative Fabian, momentarily, if you have another question.
I do, as a matter of fact. Also, Mr. Tillotson, you mentioned Costco, Tires Plus, Walmart, as companies that... Would you elaborate on what you said that their involvement in this or their support for this?
Yes, Chair Representative Fabian. Tires Plus made a lead-free commitment in late 2007, and they were totally lead-free nationwide by early 2008 in terms of all wheel balancing products, clip-on and adhesive. Costco is also lead-free, and Walmart is also lead-free, and the three of them were charter members of an EPA, a voluntary EPA initiative called the National Lead-Free Wheel Weight Initiative that was created in 2008 as a voluntary program to to move towards non-lead wheel balancing products.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I guess there again, I go back to the people that I represent. You know, we don't have Costco and Tires Plus in Northwest Minnesota. We have Northland Tire and those types of places.
Yes.
How is this going to be applied?
Chair, Representative Fabian, your businesses in Northwestern Minnesota purchase exactly the same wheel weights from the same manufacturers as Costco, Tires Plus, and Walmart. There are six manufacturers of wheel weights in the U.S. Everybody buys the wheel weights from those six companies. Every one of those companies offers a full line of non-lead products at the same price as the lead products. So when your tire companies go to their supplier and say, we're looking for a non-lead wheel balancing product, that supplier will have a full line of choices for them at the same price.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I probably my last question. So where's the data on the problem that the lead wheel weights are creating?
USGS has done a study on lead wheel weight loss, which estimated 5 to 10% loss from wheels annually in the U.S. There are other anecdotal studies conducted by a variety of organizations around the country, including government agencies. And in this case, it isn't so much demonstration of a problem as we know that lead is a risk and we have better products available today at the same price. So we'd like to move in that direction as a pollution prevention approach.
Representative Fabian, you have a question?
Yeah, I think so. You know, if I guess I'm confused. Representative Hortman, I appreciate your concern for the environment, but if we passed laws in 2008 and since, and people are on board and so forth, why do we need this bill?
Madam Chair, Representative Fabian, I'm going to say something that the PCA might not love. They're not super aggressive about going out and banning things, the PCA. These kind of bills don't come forward from the agency without doing a lot of work to make sure that there are alternatives available. And they have taken a pretty slow, measured approach to taking different products off the market. And I don't think that the Pollution Control Agency would be here today. I think a lot of the past legislation was actually member-driven and environmental group-driven. A lot of it, in particular, health-related issues. You know, there were a lot of issues with regard to mercury in the water and, you know, the health effects on pregnant women. So, you know, when we used to present these bills, we used to spend a lot of time talking about the health impacts of lead on children and mercury on children. And we kind of skipped that whole part of explaining to you why these substances are so toxic and so harmful. And I think for members who haven't been on the committee for the last 5 years, you know, maybe that would have been a useful thing for us to take the time to do. I think that's a good question that you raised of what's the harm that we're solving here. But I just would like to assure the members of the committee in my experience of 10 years serving in the legislature that the PCA has always taken a very measured, sometimes I have thought too slow approach in terms of waiting until the industry is ready. And in this case, I know there's three other members of the public that would like to testify about some concerns they have about the bill. And we may take a look at delaying the effective date to give industry time to get ready, because I think the PCA's approach is to do it when the time is right.
I think it would be appropriate to have those public folks come up and then have another group of questions for members to understand the procedure here. Representative Dill had to leave. He intends for us to get both of these bills out tonight, so folks who've been on my committee know I have ultimate patience, and we can sit here until midnight, or we can get the job done.
Madam Chair.
John Tuma, please.
May I just do one quick follow-up?
You can, but why don't we wait until we get have the public testify, that your questions may be answered. Otherwise, you are on the list.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, my name is John Tuma. I'm here on behalf of Conservation Minnesota. I'm also speaking on behalf of Clean Water Action, actually, because Deanna White wanted to be here, but she apologized that she couldn't make it tonight. So we just wanted to lend our support to Representative Hortman and the PCA. I would concur with Representative Hortman that the PCA has been very cautious. We were part of the broad coalition of organizations that came together about 5 to 10 years ago to try to push mercury legislation. It was far more contentious back then. We were dealing with much larger industries like our energy industries. So these are initiatives that we've been working on. And by the way, they're initiatives that were led by Tim Pawlenty, our Republican governor. Conservation Minnesota prides itself on being a bipartisan organization. And we believe Minnesota should be a leader in this area. And the reason we need to be leaders is because we all love our hunting and fishing and our lakes and getting out into our great outdoors. I love to fish. I love to go up and catch nice big fish up in the boundary waters. And I can tell you, we let them all go because the joke is when you catch a big fish, there's more mercury in that fish than there's probably in a thermometer. And so you only eat the small ones. And Minnesota should be a leader in this area. And we're taking these small steps. We should encourage our PCA and our agencies to continue the momentum that was started back in the Pawlenty administration towards getting rid of mercury and lead in our environment. And so we applaud Representative Horkman and the PCA for their efforts to keep that momentum moving forward.
Thank you. Mr. Quails?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tony Quails. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Thank you for allowing me time today to comment on House File 2542. The Pollution Control Agency did reach out to the Chamber of Commerce, and we did see the fact sheet that you have probably got in your packets, and we thank them for providing that to us. We did not get the language until it was introduced last Thursday, and I have reached out to our members to seek input. I have got some back, but not all, but I'd like to draw your attention to Section 4 of that bill, specifically the exemption section in there regarding agricultural food and research processing as well as industrial measurement systems. When we think of mercury thermometers, we think of the small ones that we use on my daughter or in other small individual uses. The industrial use, they're rather large. Sometimes they're encapsulated inside equipment or they're part of a chain of thermometers used to measure output or temperature as part of a permit that we get from the Pollution Control Agency. So we're checking with our members. I've talked to Representative Hortman about this, and we're going to check and keep a conversation going with the agency as well as with other folks. This is going to make a couple of stops along the way here and at another institution that is located on this campus. So we will keep working with the agency as well as the author as we move forward. But I just wanted to draw your attention specifically to Section 4 on those exemptions.
Thank you. Amber Backhouse, Minnesota Water Dealers Association.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Amber Backus, and I'm here on the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association and 385 franchise car and truck dealers in the state of Minnesota, many of which have service shops. We were initially caught off guard by this legislation, hadn't had any contact with the MPCA about it, but those conversations did start yesterday when the bill was in the Senate committee. But initially I did survey a group of our Collision and Service Advisory Council members just to get their opinions on this, and it seems like there's just a lack of information out there. Those that responded, the majority are using a product that's predominantly lead-based right now, and they're not aware of alternatives, so they were sort of surprised by this. But we would ask that there could be more education in this and potentially an extended effective date, as Representative Hortman alluded to. I did have a chance to talk to my counterpart in Maine where this was enacted, and they didn't oppose the legislation, but there was a different approach. Their pollution control agency had a three-year education and outreach program to small businesses before the legislation was passed, and then 2 years before it was effective. And not that we need a five-year timeline, but I think an education component and an opportunity for folks to be comfortable with this as well as educated would help with compliance. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify or comment on this bill? I don't see anyone. Representative Fabian, you were the next on a follow-up question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Portman, you talked about the agency being measured and so forth in their enforcement. I guess I could give you some examples of where I don't think that they've been measured. But
Representative Fabian, I meant what I was referring to was their pursuit of legislation.
Okay. Well, to that point, in their pursuit of legislation, quite frankly, I'm disappointed in that the agency didn't reach out to more of the stakeholders involved in this. When we find that when Automobilers Association finds out about it yesterday in the Senate hearing, I don't think that's a very good way to go about business in the state of Minnesota, quite frankly. And I'm very disappointed in that. This is something that I would guess has been on the boilerplate for some time, and you certainly could have reached out to the stakeholders and said, let's sit down, let's have a cup of coffee, and let's figure some of these things out. And I just don't like doing business this way, Madam Chair, and I think it's, I'm not saying necessarily that some of this stuff isn't good, but it's not the way we should be doing business in Minnesota. I'm sorry.
I'm sure the conversations have now begun. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Originally, I was kind of thinking this might be some good ideas. I am totally perplexed to hear testimony that since 2008, folks aren't using this, and then to hear people come down and say they just found out about the bill. The first I heard about the bill was just in the last day or two. I heard about the bill and just saw it recently. Madam Chair, I'll move to lay the bill over and ask for a roll call. It's not ready for this.
Right, the chair will vote? No. We do. So the motion, does everybody understand the motion? I think they do. To lay the bill over and ask for roll call. Chair votes no.
Fisher, Representative Fisher?
No.
Representative Benson?
No.
Representative Corney? Representative Fabian?
Yes.
Representative Green?
Yes.
Representative Hepper?
Aye.
Representative Hansen? Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Isaacson?
Negative.
Representative McNamara?
Aye.
Representative Purcell?
No.
Representative Ugel?
Yes.
You can call me.
Madam Chair. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Ugel.
No.
Representative Ward?
No.
I'm sorry.
There were 8 no's and 5 yeses. The motion does not carry. We will continue with the discussion. Representative Packbarth.
I'll pass.
All right. The bill is before us. Members, I see no other questions. And the chair renews the motion that House File 2542 be re-referred as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce, Consumer Protection, Finance, and Policy. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition?
No.
It carries. Thank you, members. We are going to go on to the next bill, which is House File 2543, and the chair will move that for re-referral. Representative Portman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill is also a PCA policy bill. It's a regulatory efficiency package, and I believe the reason that the PCA approached me on this bill is in 2008, I want to say, we formed the Bipartisan Small Business Caucus,
and Representative Dietrich and I and others explored the issue of how long it took for businesses to get permits. And we initiated a bill in the 09 and 10 session that I carried to streamline the permitting process. I believe Representative Fabian picked up the remainder of what I wasn't able to get passed in 2010, and he introduced it as House File 1 in 2011. So this continues along the path blazed by me in 2009 and 10 and Representative Fabian in 2011. The objective is to try to make things faster and smoother. And with me here to explain the bill is Kirk Cadell.
Thank you.
Would you like to take, I understand there's an author's amendment. Would you like to get the bill in the, this is not an author's amendment. It is.
I know there's been amendments flying back on email all day.
I have an A4 amendment. And
that is an author's amendment.
And I would move that amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author would like it. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? The amendment has been adopted. All right. Welcome to the Pollution Control Agency, Mr. Kadelka.
Madam Chair and committee members, for the record, my name is Kirk Kadelka, an assistant commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I'd like to thank Representative Portman for authoring the bill and the others before in this committee that have worked on permit timeliness. As mentioned by Representative Portman, permit timeliness is important to the agency in a number of ways. Permitting is how we make sure we meet our mission of protecting and improving the environment and enhancing public health. In addition, efficient permitting helps with economic development. And since the goal in 2011 was set for 150 days for permitting, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency has hit 97% of its priority permits within that 150-day goal. And those are the construction jobs projects, the new facilities, the expanded facilities, as we continue to move forward on that. And so in building on that success and achieving those goals, we are proposing a number of other items legislatively. However, the gains in permitting efficiency are also beyond what can be done legislatively, but by the continuous improvements that the agency continues to make through our strong continuous improvement program. I think maybe one of the easiest ways to go through the bill is kind of work off the fact sheet, and I can reference the various sections within the bill that these concepts go through. The bill does have a number of PCA and DNR provisions, and I'll make note of both of them as we go along. So the first concept is creating another tier of permitting, and this is Section 2 for the DNR and Section 6 in the bill for the PCA. As mentioned, we have a 150-day current permitting tier, and what we'd like to do is break that into two different groups, one being a 90-day permit goal for those permits where we don't have a public comment period or an individual action on a permit is not required. Those we'll keep in the 150-day goal. And the author's amendment that was just introduced defines what that is along the same lines of the fact sheet so that it isn't left up for commissioner's discretion. That was one concern we had heard, and we wanted to address that. The impact is about 75% of our permits would now be within that 90-day goal. The next item is creating 10-year non-federal permits. Over the last couple years, a couple areas of state-only permits for landfills and feedlots were changed to 10-year permits. What we're looking to do here is expand that to other solid waste and water permits. And some of those examples include compost facilities, transfer stations, or large systems, those over 10,000 gallons per day, the type of cluster systems you may see in a development. We believe this is good practice. It will still protect the environment because these do represent less risk to human health and the environment. Any modifications to the facility, so if there's a major change, they would still have to come in and make those changes. However, what this does is if the business is keeping as it is, as they follow the current laws, they wouldn't have to come in every 5 years. They wouldn't have to do the additional paperwork or pay the renewal application fee. They could have this for 10 years. That's Section 4 and 12 of the bill. The next two are interrelated. This really works with expediting permitting process. currently the agency in the statute in Section 7 for the MPCA allows for expedited permits in a case where a business would like things to move quicker, and we use and rely on overtime of staff mostly to accomplish that, although sometimes we may use contractors that we have oversight over. Section 3 of the bill also extends this to DNR so that they have this ability. What we're looking to do is expand this so that additional outside overtime can be used for working on these type of projects if there's needs. And an example where we may see this is a new industry that comes through. Ethanol was an industry that came forward, wanted to strike while the iron was hot, and had a number of facilities they wanted to get through in a timely fashion. It created a large mass that came in that the agency, an industry, could pay for additional if they would like. We could staff up to meet that demand and then staff back down when it's not there. This would prevent the agency from just having staff there and bringing up and increasing everyone's permit fees to cover that. This is why those who want the service will have to pay for it and get that extra result. The next piece deals with our business first stop, and that's Section 11. Minnesota Business First Stop is located in Deed. It is a multi-agency effort, including MPCA, where we help businesses from everything from financial assurance to permitting and helping them with the regulatory system so that they can locate and get up and running quickly. What we'd like to do is this already allows for some times of assistance from agencies, but many times a large project, a new technology comes about, and they're not quite sure how they fit in the system. And this is way before they even set in an application. They're trying to find out what other concepts works, which one might make it easier to get through the permitting process. As an agency, we help where we can, but obviously those permits in the house will work on those construction permits first. And if they would like more expedited service, they have something that they really need to do, they want to strike while the iron's hot, this would allow for them to pay for that extra service without spreading the cost on everyone else. The second page, we start with the water quality trading. We believe this will add a large benefit. As various types of treatment for pollution becomes more expensive in some cases, we're looking for other ways to help pass on the efficiencies or reducing pollution in other sources to make that same environmental level of protection and restoration, but share ways that can simplify. And an example of this is in the Minnesota River Basin. There have been communities, for instance, Sacred Heart is working with the city of Mankato through a trade where they only have to pay $400 a year to meet their phosphorus requirements. Mankato, because of a larger facility, economy of scale, can make that reduction for them. And when we do this, we make sure that it still balances out to provide the protection there. What this legislation allows us to do is use it in more situations. Currently, we're restricted to nutrients only and during a certain amount of time. And that's why we'd like to continue moving forward. And we see this as a good way to work with partnerships to get the same environmental benefit and reduce costs. And that is Section 5 of the bill. Section 1 of the bill deals with the Minnesota Data Practices Act. This is a lot like TurboTax. The agency currently is working on an IT transformation project. A number of our databases that hold permitting information, environmental data, and others have become old, and we are in the process of replacing it. Much like TurboTax, we would like to build a system where someone on their home computer can start building their annual reports to the agencies, work on applications for a new project that they're working on, work on it, hit save, come back to it. So just like when they're dealing with paper at home, that information is private. It's only when they take the act in TurboTax, when they send it to the IRS or Department of Revenue, or if a piece of paper when they hand it to the PCA is a public information. And we would like to update the Data Practices Act to move with this new technology. Section 2 and Section 6 of the bill is changing when the permitting efficiency report is due. It's currently done twice a year. And because we're looking at goals that range from 150 days, a report 180 days, it doesn't show a good picture. We really need that larger span of time to see the any movement. And so we believe this would be a more efficient use of resources. We've talked a lot about permitting timeliness today. One of the other areas that is just as important is compliance and enforcement timeliness. Because again, it helps meet our goals of protecting and improving the environment, enhancing public health, much like permitting. In addition, resolving compliance issues also help with permit timeliness. Many times when a facility comes in and they may have a lingering compliance issue, Those things need to be wrapped up before we can issue their permit to expand. So it's in their interest to get that done in a rapid fashion. What I want to do is just start off here by talking about what this doesn't do, these next couple sections. This does not increase the maximum penalties that the agency can levy. That's in another section of statute under Chapter 115.071, where the maximums per day per violation are listed. That is not being changed in this, and I've got that statute I can hand out later if folks are interested. What we are proposing to do is change some other mechanisms. And in Section 8, we make two changes. One is an administrative penalty order, and when it's used when there's multiple parties to a situation. There's been an interpretation, if there are multiple parties, we can only use this tool if, in aggregate, their penalty was under $10,000. We believe the interpretation it was for each inspection in that. And so a real-life situation here is in the case of asbestos, where the removal was done incorrectly. There may be a number of folks that have some aspect of that. It could be the removal contractor, the demolition contractor, and the project manager. After going through it, and we just decide each should be assigned a $6,000 penalty, we can't use this tool. What ends up happening is we have to use a different tool, which takes more time. In general, when we're looking at timeliness, an administrative penalty order from discovery to closure is 250 plus days to get that taken care of. Some of our other tools, if we can't use an administrative penalty order, is a stipulation agreement. Then we start getting from discovery to closure up to 850 days. So this is one reason we would like to use administrative penalty orders. The other change is when we can use this on some of those requirements on when we use it. In a normal case, when we find a compliance situation, we go in and first we look at and see what happened, what was the impact, and how do we fix it. And later we then look at whether or not a penalty should be done. We have a number of enforcement tools, but and many of those are non-penalized issues, such as letters of warning or notice of violation. But if because of the impact to the environment, history of past use, willfulness, and other contributing factors, a penalty may be required. And if that's the case, we find out the dollar amount. If it's something that ends up in, say, the $10,000 to $20,000 range, this is an area where we would like to use the administrative penalty order because we can get it resolved quickly. We can get it fixed. Administrative penalty order can only be used in situations where a remedy can be done in 30 days. If this is a larger issue, we understand we have to use other tools. But this would help in a situation. And an example is in 2010, there was an unpermitted wastewater discharge from a processing plant, where when we went through all the issues, we looked at it and said that, you know, this should be something that should fall within the $20,000 penalty range. Looking at that case, what we could do is it would have taken 150 days less time if we were able to use an administrative penalty order compared to others. Finally, Section 9 and 10 deal with SSTS, septic system violations. When looking at these violations, they tend to follow in certain buckets and arrive at a certain amount, at similar amounts. One way to expedite the correction action here is for field citations. So in statute in Section 9 and 10, you see those reoccurring situations, and since they're over and over the same dollar amount, we're just going to put them in statute, and then that way we can use a field citation, which would help move up the situation. That's the bill. There's one piece that's in the author's amendment that I just want to highlight that is a little different, and that's if you look at the amendment, starting on line 1.12 through line 1.25 is how the SSTS septic system tank fees process works. Currently, it is a cumbersome process for the three parties involved, counties, the MPCA, and the installers that pay the fee. We're proposing a different structure that would help make it easier and less confusing for all involved, and so folks have the certainty of what's going on, and we believe this would be an improvement. We've talked to the professionals that would be the ones that potentially could have a violation under this. Earlier versions they were supportive of, and we've also shared this with the counties, and they have reviewed it also. With that, I'd wrap it up and thank you for your time, and if you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them.
Madam Chair, I would like to reiterate one point that Mr. Kudelka made, because I thought it was very confusing when I read the draft of the bill, and I just draw members' attention to page 12, section 8. when they came into my office with this proposed bill, I said, why do you want to double the penalties? And it took me a while to understand what they're doing here. Is what they're doing is they're raising the limit on situations that can go to the less onerous dispute resolution process. So it would be like raising the limit for a conciliation court case. When we raise the limit for a conciliation court case from $7,500 to $15,000, we're letting more people use a cheaper process to resolve disputes. And so in this case, what the agency is doing is taking more people and putting them through the faster, cheaper way of solving problems rather than the more cumbersome, long-term, expensive way of solving problems. So the better way to look at Section 8 is a reduction in attorney's fees spent by the business involved, because we're moving from a process of 856 days to 256 days. So I think the way it's drafted, it's confusing because the only section, the only portion of 116.072 you have is Subdivision 2. But if you look at the remainder of 116.072, that becomes apparent, and the handout, I think, shows that.
Members, I am cognizant of the hour, and I think maybe for efficiency purposes, if they're clarifying questions, we'll take them now, then we'll take public testimony, and then we'll have a discussion of the bill. Is that okay with members? Okay. I'm getting a kind of signal that that's okay. So we have Mr. Quillis is up, and then I will ask if anybody else in the audience would like to testify.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, I'm Tony Quillis. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The Minnesota Chamber of Commerce thanks the Pollution Control Agency and Representative Hortman for having this conversation on permit efficiency. Our board has identified this as an issue area that we would like to pursue legislatively. If you remember, 3 years ago on a bipartisan basis with this legislature and the Dayton administration, we've moved some initiatives forward. So anytime we can have this conversation, we look forward to it. In terms of just very quickly on some of the things that are in the bill, Mr. Kadelka and Chair Hortman and I have had conversations about tiered permitting. We think that's a good thing. We have some different views on what the tiers may be and what would be in those tiers. Mr. Kadelka has in the, I think, I don't know if it's been adopted or not, in the author's amendment, defined that a little bit more. Originally, as the bill is introduced, we had some questions about whether the commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency, after the report that they do twice a year, will be done once a year under this bill, that he would get to set what those tiers are. We just have some differences of opinion on how that would go. Again, you've heard some conversations about the APOs and the nutrient treating. We're working with the agency and the author, but we look forward to having this conversation. Again, I think this bill is going to have a couple more stops, and so we look forward to the conversation, and thank you for the time, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Others in the audience? Others in the audience? No others in the audience, then we will go to members' questions. Members' questions? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hortman, you may have been confused when they came in your office, but I'm totally confused now. We've got a piece of paper handed out to us. It's 115.071. You're talking about 116.072. I don't think I've got the right. I can't follow what you're talking about. It's really not an increase. It's a decrease.
Mr.
Kadelka. Madam Chair and committee members, the handout is the authority the agency has for the maximum penalties. We wanted to illustrate that is an entirely different part of statute. We are not changing that. Subdivision 3 is where it has that amount of the maximum for penalties for violations, and then the difference for maximum for hazardous waste-related penalties. We just want to show and illustrate the difference that they are different sections of statute. We are not changing the maximum penalty amount.
I have an amendment here that may, and I don't know, I don't have a name on the amendment. I have an A2 amendment. It's the only one I have, pardon? That may be the time to discuss this issue if you would like to move the amendment or not.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move the amendment at least for discussion.
That amendment, Representative Fabian has moved Amendment A2. It's before us for discussion. If the author would like to reiterate what she said before, I think that would clarify what is in this bill.
Representative Fabian, this was exactly where I was coming from when they walked into my office. I was thinking, well, I can carry this bill as long as they take this section out. But I think what your amendment would do is what it throws people back into the more onerous dispute resolution process. So people who would be fined between $10,001 and $20,000, instead of having access to the cheaper, faster APO process, would be thrown back in the soup with the longer process. I forget what they call it, but that it takes on an average of 856 days. So I think it would be more pro-business to not adopt the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair, but and I'm not necessarily disagreeing with you. Some of this stuff is a little confusing. You've had a couple more days to digest this than I have. That being said, on lines 12.9, 12.10, and 12.11, beginning July 1, 2019, every 5 years thereafter, we're adjusting for inflation. If we want to be business-friendly, then I'm not sure where that is being business-friendly.
Madam Chair, Representative Fabian, and that's a different section of the bill, and Mr. Kodalka will address that section.
No, it's not. No, it's not. I'm sorry, Madam. I'm sorry.
The inflationary piece.
Madam Chair and committee members, this is so that as time goes on, that same amount of ability, it doesn't erode on time. As Representative Portman has mentioned, as inflation increases, this ability to move into the more efficient and less attorney cost process erodes over time. And this keeps it just as it continues to move along. So it keeps that same level of value to businesses and others who would be in this situation. It's modeled off of what the EPA does for its penalty system.
Madam Chair, Representative Fabian, I think the best way I can think of it and understand it is the conciliation court example. So if today you can go into conciliation court at $15,000, then in a year, $15,000 is a different amount. But we still want the smaller disputes to go to conciliation court. So if we adjust it with inflation, we keep steering small disputes to conciliation court, even though the actual dollar in controversy goes up. But it's only going up by the amount of inflation.
Madam Chair, you know, I guess I'm willing to withdraw my amendment, but what are the following stops for this bill? Do you have any?
I think it has a number of stops. If you would like to list them, I know.
I know there's a lot.
You will have an opportunity in finance to revisit this bill.
Okay, I'll withdraw my amendment. Thank you.
Okay. All right, members, I don't see any other questions or concerns. Did I miss something? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Packer.
Well, Representative Fabian had follow-up questions. Okay, I'll go first then. Thank you, Madam Chair. On, let's see, what is this section? Section 9 of the bill. Mr. Kodalka, could you explain that section a little bit better to me? Just everyone in my district has a septic tank, and I'm wondering what we're doing here. How are my septic folks going to feel about this, the people that do the pumping and the installing and the repairing of septic systems? How are they going to feel about this section of the bill? Are they going to like this? Tell me a little bit more about what this actually does. From your explanation earlier, it sounded like it's going to be easier to find these people, who's going to go after them? Who does the enforcement on this?
Madam Chair and committee members, good questions. I'll just start off on page 13 there. That is a list of a number of items within the rules dealing with SSTS, and most of them, you're correct, are dealing with the professionals that do this type of work, including whether they have a bond or they're following the requirements. And so what we've done when we've looked at these, we find they tend to fall in that $1,000 to $3,000 range, these type of violations. They keep the same pattern. They're reoccurring. And so instead of going through the much longer process of putting together an administrative penalty order, which it does have some more requirements and time on the businesses, they want to get things quickly fixed and move on to the next thing and get this behind them. No one wants a lingering potential compliance and enforcement case hanging over their head, so they want to resolve this. We have shared it with the operators with this concept in the past, and we have not heard back any opposition to it. They've been part of the implementation and enforcement task force. There's a member of MAW on that group.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, that was going to be part of my questions. You know, I looked through here the new language on page 15. We've got all kinds of new language for increased penalties. I'm just really, really uncomfortable with some of this stuff. Mr. Gadelka, you talked about you have your concerns and so forth, but just like the previous bill, you don't have any data here to support the problems that you're having. With regards to septic systems, we seem to be just looking for a problem.
Madam Chair and committee members, we did pull information on septic system administrative penalty orders from the fiscal years 2009 to 2013, and during that time, there were 121 situations where we did take on an administrative penalty order where there was a penalty. There were others, many more, that were resolved through letters of warning, notices of violation that didn't have penalties. And under that situation, we believe of 121, 68 of them could be resolved in a much quicker fashion using the field citation. This would be the same amount of penalty. It's just a process that moves along quicker, requires less attorneys and others being involved in the process. Having said that, though, that does not eliminate their ability to appeal. They have an entire process to appeal, whether it's to the Office of Administrative Hearing, to have their case heard before an administrative law judge. An administrative law judge, it's not like a normal courtroom. They will help the person out. They don't have to have the same legal understanding, nothing against attorneys, but it's much simpler for folks to work through that system and get them heard in a way that's fair to them. Also, they have the option to still go to the district court. There are still appeal processes built into this.
Okay, I did hear the crack about attorneys. I know that this is an anti-attorney bill because there won't be as much need for attorneys, but I am going to let that pass to Representative Hackbarth. We'll have the last question, and then we're going to call for a vote.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and you make this sound like it's easier for the these septic folks to move on. It's also easier for the MPCA, you didn't answer the other question on who's enforcing this, to go out and find these people. It's now we have we can go out and write them a ticket, and now we're going to get $500, and it's easier to get it that way than to go through the APO process. It's easier for you guys to come up with more money to tag them. And I think it's going to be more of a burden on these people than we think it is. And I think we're going to start getting complaints from them, and we're going to have to come back and fix this thing once these folks find out exactly what we're doing to them. This is terrible, terrible legislation.
Well, we will have another opportunity in finance to go over some of these same questions. I renew my motion that House File 2543 be re-referred as amended and re-referred to the Jobs, Economic Development, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition?
No.
It is passed on. It's re-referred and as amended. Thank you, members. We have two sections of minutes for February 25th. Is there somebody who would be so kind? Representative Purcell moves the minutes of February 25th.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? Those minutes are adopted. We have the minutes of March 4th. Representative Porcel will move the minutes of March 4th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? Minutes are adopted.